Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is The Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host, as always, Dr. Wesley Francis, the extraordinary Bahamian surgical oncologist and general surgeon. We are honored to have in the studio. I will let you do the introductions, Dr. Francis.
We have a surprise, special for our guests today, for our listeners. And we have all the way from Barbados, a young lady who has, been a scholar and who has excelled and decided to come back to the Caribbean, but she's decided to choose our good country to come back to.
An academic,
yes. So we have is Dr. Rogel Morris, who is a cardiologist. She's a specialized cardiologist, and I'm not going to say exactly what it is yet because we have to get into it. We have to break it down. And she's here today to share with us on matters of the heart. And we know that cardiovascular disease is a big problem in our country, and it's a killer. And but mostly because we always talk about the coronary arteries. And cardiovascular disease causing heart attacks. But there's a little more to the heart than actual the blood vessels. The heart is actually a pump, and it has an electrical activity. And so sometimes that wiring goes bad. And Dr. Morris is here today to talk to us about the electrical activity of the heart, because she is an electrical physiologist. Very, very highly specialized cardiologist. Welcome, Roselle.
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction. Hi, Dr. Pinto. Such a great pleasure to join you and Dr. Francis today. To just give the Bahamian public just a feel for what I do and hopefully help educate the public as well.
Absolutely. Tell us a little about yourself. I know you're from Barbados. Tell us about your journey.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was born in Barbados, grew up in a small area, which had no beach around it.
Oh, wow.
So I had to go about 15 minutes to go to the beach. Either way, grew up in Barbados, went to one of the top schools. I don't know if any Barbadians are listening out there, but I went to Combermere School. Everybody
I'm sure
raves about that. And then my journey took me to Mona to do medical school.
Ah, Mona. That's both Greg and I went to Mona.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I went back to Barbados to do my internship and then went on to do internal medicine. And then after internal medicine, so I did DM, I went to do cardiology at the University of Toronto and then continued my specialty training into cardiac electrophysiology. So just a big term to say, I just deal with rhythm issues of the heart.
And that's, I need our audience to understand that because the heart is a muscle that beats. And, you know, I remember when I was in training, one of our professors always called the heart a dumb muscle. it just continues to beat whatever, right? Whatever you do to it, it just continues to beat. And that is because of its peculiar electrical activity or wiring. And it's a well-ordered system. So take us into the basics so that our audience could understand about the electrical activity or electrical anatomy of the heart and then some of the things that can go wrong.
Sure. So I think the electricity, as you said, is that the heart is, I don't want to say, what did you say just now?
It's don't
repeat
me.
That.
I know.
I feel insulted as a cardiologist.
You keep beating no matter what. When it stops, you're dead.
The beauty about the heart is that it has its own pacing cells. So those are automatic cells. Those, you know, just pretty much just continue to send signals to the heart muscle and tell it to beat. We don't need any signaling from anywhere else. It just, as you said, continues to beat. So these cells are highly specialized, found in the top right, what I call chamber of the heart. But really, as you said, I see the heart muscle as a house. And with the house, there's electricity, and that electricity starts in the top part of the heart, and that kind of continues down to the lower level or the bottom or ground floors of the heart. And then those continue to go to all the heart muscle cells and allows the heart to beat in a kind of synchronized fashion or organized fashion.
That's good. So most of the problems that we know that, you know, the public faces is usually related to the blood vessels and the heart not getting enough blood supply or oxygen. And that's what we kind of associate as a heart attack, almost like a stroke, right? The blood flow going, the heart has a demand. It needs blood flow. And again, as we say, it keeps beating, so it needs blood flow. Mm-hmm. And that's what we commonly used to. And, you know, Greg and I, we always talk about lifestyle modifications and common non-communicable diseases that kill our people. And one of the major ones of those is heart disease.
Well, I mean, this every show we do is very important, but this is fundamentally important because not many things in life are inevitable other than death. But atherosclerosis, plaque deposition within the arteries, is an inevitable part to some degree in all of us, men and women, if we reach a ripe old age. And I'm talking even just over the age of 60. So atherosclerosis is a leading cause of cardiovascular events, which is a leading cause of death in the Bahamas in every country in the world. Mm-hmm. So what you are saying, Dr. Morris, may save the life of one of our listeners or someone that they love. So this is fundamentally important, what you're saying. We want to know, how do we prevent heart attacks and how do we screen for potential signs of a impending heart? We talk about all the time. Well, I speak about it more. Erectile dysfunction can be an early sign of cardiovascular disease. There's a strong correlation.
There is.
So maybe you can speak a little bit more about that. But what can we do in terms of lifestyle to live longer, live better? That's a mantra of this show.
Yeah, thank you for that question. So generally, especially when it comes to cardiovascular disease, and if we're specifically talking about the blood vessels of the heart, where we're talking about coronary artery disease, most people know that these are generally caused by our non-communicable diseases. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about high blood pressure or hypertension, as we would call it. We're talking about high blood sugar, so diabetes, high cholesterol, dyslipidemia. We're talking about the obesity, the sedentary lifestyles where people are pretty much inactive, not exercising. These are all risk factors for coronary disease.
And, of course, age and Can't forget smoking.
Yes, smoking. Yeah. Smoking, big one. And alcohol intake, generally, if it's, you know, a high intake of alcohol. So just generally, those are risk factors that we all know. And these cause, you know, people to be at risk for having a heart attack. So how do we prevent them? For some people, as you know, this deposition of atherosclerosis or plaque formation in the coronary arteries starts from even childhood. And I think that kind of follows you throughout your entire life. And they are what we call either genetic risk factors, or it could just be lifestyle that can impact you having your plaque formation in the blood vessels of the heart. So genetics, if you have a family history of high cholesterol, that generally plays a important role. And then if you have a lifestyle in terms of what we talked about just now, where it's sedentary, you're a smoker, you have your eating habits, so your diets, which is also an important thing, where you have a diet which is high in fats and low in fiber.
So and essentially high in, the Western diet.
Yes.
And
yes.
One question while you're, sorry to disturb.
Sure.
Is African ancestry a risk factor?
It is. It is. When you look at all the studies that are out there, so being African-American or African, there is an increased risk of heart disease in our population generally.
And that goes beyond just the socioeconomics and the being disadvantaged. Okay.
Beyond it.
Okay.
Yes.
So the take-home message, and we say it all the time, what we do in our youth, we pay for in our older years. Right. So in our teenage years, if we're living carelessly and don't think about tomorrow, we're going to pay for it in our 40s, in our 50s, in our 60s. We talk about trying to stratify patients and determine who do we need to really, you know, we need to pull you aside. We need to, behavioral modifications, diet modification. You need to exercise. We need to put you on statins. We need to do so many things to take you down away from the road from getting a heart attack, or we'll even go further to a stroke. So we talk about blood tests that are coming available. We talk about ApoB marker, which many regard as the number one blood test to predict heart attacks and the risk for heart attacks. And what exactly is that? I know it's a lipoprotein. It's looking at the concentration of the very bad, harmful lipoprotein. That's LDLs and the very LDLs.
Yeah.
So how is that more specific or sensitive in terms of predicting heart disease and just general? The triglycerides, the total cholesterol, the LDL, and the HDL.
Sure. So apolipoprotein B, as it's called, it actually binds to your low-density lipoproteins. And even before your LDL starts to go up, the apolipoprotein B starts to go up before you actually see it on a blood test. So people tend now to use this as a marker as opposed to using just your LDL or your total cholesterol to tell you what your risk for developing that atherosclerosis in the heart.
And so, who do you recommend get this apolipoprotein B test? At what age? And
I would say, so is a very important question. Generally, I would say if you're over 40, definitely it is a test that I would definitely recommend for anybody over 40.
Every year?
Every year. Okay. Every year. Is an expensive test, it is. But is something that you know, definitely should have at least once a year. One of the things that I do know is that along with that, so just before I continue with that. So with the apolipoprotein B, if you have a history of diabetes, hypertension, definitely you should also have your apolipoprotein B done. So it's something that you should probably ask your primary care doctor about doing. And just see where you are at on the, in terms of your risk.
Yeah. And another test is a calcium score test, a CT scan. They also call it the coronary artery calcium score, CACS. So this is a non-invasive CT scan that's readily available in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. It measures the amount of calcified plaque in your heart's arteries to determine an individual's potential risk for a heart attack, heart disease, and or stroke. And this is a painless test.
Painless.
It doesn't involve dye. It doesn't involve contrast. You just lay there in the CT scan tube for a few minutes. It's not even a long test.
Yeah.
How important is that, and how good a predictor is it in terms of our risk for developing a heart attack or getting a stroke later in life?
Yeah. So the test is highly specialized, to be honest. So it's not just lying there. Generally, what we do is we do a gated ECG, CT, coronary calcium score test, where you kind of use your heart rate to kind of gauge how blood flows through your coronary arteries and then see what calcium deposits are in your coronary arteries. So generally the test is used for, again, risk stratifying patients that you believe may have coronary artery disease who are asymptomatic generally, but do have a risk for having coronary artery disease. So it's not for those who may have already had an event. And when I say an event, somebody who's already had, like, for example, a heart attack or even a stroke, I don't think is beneficial in those patients, but generally in patients who you think may be at risk for coronary disease. And even if they've had a stress test, for example, because generally we start out by doing a stress test, even stress testing may not necessarily be beneficial, but certainly the coronary CT, which is painless, can tell you what a person's risk. So a high calcium score risk, I can't remember what the exact number is, but that generally gives you a good predictor in terms of what that person's risk for coronary artery disease is.
And is there a benefit in doing the tests on older persons? For example, 70-year-olds, everyone's going to have calcification.
Yeah, so everybody who's probably over 75 tends to have calcium deposits already. So it's not useful in that population. It's also not useful in populations who have a high calcium deposition. So we're talking about patients who have end-stage kidney disease. Those patients already have high calcium deposits because of their high parathyroid hormone. Generally, those are, you know, not tests you would generally do your calcium CT scoring in.
Okay. Well, let's talk about something that I hear all the time, and men are always talking about, and a lot of it is old wives' tale, or it's a neighborhood legend where older man was with a younger, we call here sweetheart, this girl on the side, and had a heart attack. And they always blame Viagra. Although there are many PDE5 inhibitors, but Viagra is always the one that at risk. So from my understanding, and I believe I have a pretty good understanding, but it's really unstable angina with the use of nitrates, where someone feels like the elephant is pressing down on their chest, and they have to put that nitrate under their tongue to relieve that excruciating pain. Obviously, if you take a nitrate and you take what is the reason why a Viagra and a nitrate can lead to your death?
Because it does cause issues with the electricity. So it increases your risk for getting what we call ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation. So patients can actually die suddenly just from that, what we call destabilization of the electrical activity. And then, you know, that's my area, which I love.
So let's circle back to our area now.
I mean,
because, you know, we started talking about the electrical activity of the heart. We spoke about coronary artery disease, number one killer. You know, talk to us about palpitations. I mean, I think a lot of people experience this. And how frequent or how common is it? And what are some of the things that are increases your risk of palpitation? Or is it dangerous? Or is it just something that, you know, you live with?
So when I talk about palpitations, I tend to talk about whether it's benign or not dangerous or malignant or dangerous. So for her, generally, I would say, first of all, palpitations is just an annoyance. It's a nuisance for a lot of people. And people tend to, for me as a cardiologist, I don't just look at what your risks are, but also what your quality of life is. And some people generally do not like palpitations because they feel uncomfortable. They worry about whether or not it can increase their risk for a heart attack or increase their risk of a stroke. But what I would say is if you were young, most times if you do have palpitations, that is usually what we consider to be benign or is caused by some electrical activity of the heart that comes from the top chamber of the heart. So something we term a supraventricular tachycardia. So it's just the above the bottom chamber. So the top chambers of the heart are affected. And the most common one, usually not in younger people. So we're talking about people who are 80-year-olds. So one in every 80-year-old tends to be affected by this, but the most common rhythm problem that I face almost every day is atrial fibrillation.
Okay, good. Tell us more about that. I mean,
it's very common, first of all.
Yeah, it's common, right?
But what are the symptoms of atrial fibrillation? What would a typical individual be feeling, and then they have to query, you know what, I might have atrial fibrillation, which can be the cause of your sudden death. Don't ignore it. What are the symptoms that someone may present with?
So let me just say, it is not a dangerous rhythm problem. Mm-hmm. It is actually considered to be somewhat benign in that it's not going to kill you. What it does cause, though, it may increase your morbidity in terms of, you know, if you do have atrial fibrillation for a long time, it can affect the heart muscle. So atrial fibrillation is the top chamber of the heart going erratically, going quickly, and that then causes you to have palpitations which you feel or determine to be erratic. Some people do feel them. Some people actually do not feel them.
And what is the role of anticoagulation? There's so many persons on Xarelto, or what's the advantage of doing cardioversion so you don't have to be on those anticoagulants?
I believe in cardioversions, like wholeheartedly. If I see you and you have atrial fibrillation for the first time, I always give you a chance to be cardioverted, meaning that I think you should be in the rhythm you were born with. I don't believe in you people staying in atrial fibrillation unless it's, you know, they're asymptomatic with it. But I still give everybody a chance, especially if they present with atrial fibrillation, the chance to be in a normal rhythm. So to be cardioverted. So in terms of the role of anticoagulation, the role of it is to prevent the risk of a stroke. And the reason why people with atrial fibrillation actually develop strokes is because of their risk factors. So if you have atrial fibrillation and you're over 65, generally we say that you are at increased risk for developing a stroke with atrial fibrillation, because atrial fibrillation can cause a clot in the top chamber of the heart, and that can break off and go to the brain. And then other risks, like if you have a history of heart failure, if you have a history of vascular disease, I know the surgeons are here, and if you have a history of diabetes, hypertension, those things increase your risk, or if you've even had a stroke before, those things increase your risk with atrial fibrillation of having another stroke or having a stroke. So that's the role of anticoagulation.
And a lot of persons confuse, what is the difference between atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter?
So they're cousins. And I leave the rhythm problem in terms of differentiating them to the cardiologist to some extent. Sometimes they're very difficult to differentiate on ECG. But flutter is more organized. That's what we tend to say as electrophysiologists. The atrial flutter is more organized, whether it comes from the right side of the heart, which is the most common type of atrial flutter, or it can come from the left side of the heart, which we determine to be atypical, which sometimes looks very closely to atrial fibrillation.
So part of the annual physical should be an ECG starting at
age
40?
At age 40.
Okay, and then every year after that?
Every 6 months after that.
And who should get an echo? Should you just get a routine echo at some point, and at what age?
I had the same conversation yesterday with a colleague of mine. He does family practice, and he asked me the same question, like, you know, what is your threshold for doing an echocardiogram? Because I'm a cardiologist, I have a very low threshold for doing echo. I just simply think that a lot of people have silent disease that we do not know about. And for me, I feel like if you have an abnormal ECG, you warrant getting an echo. Especially if you do also have things like, you know, those risk factors. So you're talking about your diabetes, your hypertension. If you have risk factors for sudden death. So if somebody in your family, especially first degree relative, you die suddenly, that is somebody for sure I want to have an ECG on early on, even earlier than 40 years old, just if they have a hereditary issue.
And that's a 12-lead?
A 12-lead ECG. Yeah.
So I see a lot of patients who known to have atrial fibrillation. They'll come for some surgical problem. and they're on a lot of medication, one, the anticoagulation, and also medications to control the rate, meaning how fast the heart goes. You mentioned something earlier about cardioversion.
A question I would always have, and I have with Denise, is someone who's known with atrial fibrillation, they're on Xarelto. We obviously have to stop the Xarelto two or three days before.
Yes.
How long is it safe to discontinue the Xarelto even post-operatively if someone has a risk of bleeding? Obviously, it plays, it depends on the individual and everything else. But is it safe to stop Xarelto for a week for the typical person with atrial fibrillation?
No. I just say 24 to 48. Yeah, so 48 hours, two days for usually, most people. And then I say 2 days in terms of restarting it for most people, unless they have bleeding perioperatively. And then we would kind of reevaluate that.
Yeah, okay. So always 2 days. I always say two days before, two days after.
Yeah.
And I mean, you obviously, as a surgeon, you got to be very meticulous about hemostasis, about stopping bleeding.
Yeah.
But you mentioned cardioversion, because I see a lot of people who have AFib, they're on a lot of medication. But cardioversion, what is cardioversion, and is that available to people in our community at this time?
Of course. Cardioversion is something, like, for me, I feel it's quite easy to do.
Okay.
So I tend to reserve cardioversion for first-timers. So if you come for the first time in atrial fibrillation, I think you warrant going back into normal rhythm.
Okay.
The question is, most times, 99% of the time, you go back into your normal rhythm. The next question is, will you stay into your normal rhythm? I always have to ask myself that. And that is dependent on, you know, the size of the left top chamber of the heart, which is the left atrium. Generally, if the left atrium is larger than what it should be, your risk for going back into atrial fibrillation is high. And then also the use of what we call antiarrhythmic therapy. So I tend to want to do it alongside with those particular drugs to keep you in your normal rhythm.
Gotcha. So those people who you have on antiarrhythmic therapies, they then can avoid being on anticoagulation then?
No.
Or they still have to be on anticoagulation?
They still have to be. Okay. So once you just have the risk of having a stroke, and we use a particular scoring system called the CHAS-VASc scoring system, it's just a mnemonic talking about all the other risks. Generally, we say if your CHAS-VASc is over 2, you warrant being on anticoagulation.
So what about that young person? Because you mentioned how, you know, we talked about palpitation.
Yes.
You mentioned palpitation could be benign or malignant. And what about that young person who, after drinking coffee, they have more of an awareness of their heartbeat, skipping and all of that? What would you say to that person? Is that something to be concerned about, or is that just, you know, we could ignore that?
So it's hard to say ignore, especially if the person is bothered significantly by it. But certainly it warrants me trying to figure out what is causing the palpitations. Usually if it's related to coffee, usually benign, I would say. Most times, a lot of us have what we call skipped beats or extra beats. So those are like your premature atrial contractions. And those can be kind of stimulated by, you know, our stimulants like caffeine. Mm. But certainly, I would say those are somewhat benign.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we talked about palpitations. We talked about atrial fibrillations. Are there any other, like, more dangerous rhythms in the heart that can we mention some of those so that our people would be aware?
So those dangerous rhythms, yes. So these we tend to call the ventricular rhythms. So the rhythms coming from the bottom chamber of the heart, and those generally occur with or alongside either you having issues with the actual structure or muscle of the heart. Mm. And sometimes that muscle issue can be because of the same plumbing problems of the heart. So atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries generally tends to come alongside with the dangerous rhythms. So we're talking about ventricular tachycardia, ventricular fibrillation. And those two rhythms are actually pretty dangerous in terms of they can quickly degenerate to the point where your heart stops.
I think it's important that the public understand that if you are having a heart attack or myocardial infarction, that you need to get to emergency room ASAP.
Time is muscle, yes.
So we need to determine or let the public know what are the signs. I know maybe, I think it's 50%. I haven't gone through cardiology in a long time, but about 50% of first heart attacks, the symptom and result is actually sudden death. But
yes.
What do you feel? You feel pain in your mid-chest, your sternum? Is it
yes.
a stabbing pain? Is it go down the arm? Is that
usually can be a crushing pain, like somebody heaviness sitting.
Going to your jaw as
going
well.
To your jaw. You can have pain going to your jaw, going to your left shoulder, numbness going down your arm as well, left arm, even right arm as well. So any pain for me, especially if it's crushing and continuous, is something that you should take seriously and you should go to the emergency room immediately.
Well, you're going to hear, well, as you get to know the Bahamian public more, that most people are going to say it's gas.
Gas.
It's always gas. No matter what, it's
everything
gas.
Everything is gas, man.
Everything is gas.
No. So, I feel you because the Barbadian public does the same thing as well. But there are heart attacks as well that do feel like gas, to be honest.
Yes.
So what we talk about is these heart attacks that occur mostly are affecting the bottom walls of the heart tend to come with like epigastric pain. So pain in the top part of the stomach, that too, especially if it's unusual. For me, I always tell people if it feels unusual, if it doesn't feel like something you've experienced before and it is somewhat disabling to some extent, you should always go to the emergency room.
And it's always better to be safe than sorry.
Better to be safe than sorry.
And obviously,
and time is muscle.
Very much so.
Time is muscle. So the quicker you get to the hospital for care, especially when it comes to a heart attack, your muscle gets saved.
And everybody knows the frustration of the overwhelmed public system, PMH, emergency room. But if you come with the signs, symptoms, complaints of a possible heart attack, you go up to the number one.
Number
on the list.
One, yes.
Just as someone who gets stabbed or shot, you go to the number one. And you're not going to be waiting. So don't think, you know what, I can't bother to wait 8 hours in the emergency room. You're not going. You're going to be seen immediately. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
And even if it's a false alarm, that's a good false alarm.
Yes.
Other than to regret ultimate death.
You exactly.
You can be saving your ultimate death. So please, even if it's your uncle or if it's your grandfather, put them in the car, get ambulance there, and get them to the hospital immediately.
Yes.
Immediately.
Yes.
So
one of the things you mentioned, and I just wanted you to sort of reiterate it for our audience, you described atypical sort of scenarios with pain going down the right arm, because you know everybody thinking the left arm, right? And also jaw, because sometimes people would think that they're having a toothache. And I've actually seen that, you know, complaining of what they think is a bad toothache, but actually they're having. How common do you see these sort of atypical symptoms?
Believe it or not, I feel like it's 50% of the time.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I think some things that we also need to be aware of is that sometimes there is that warning weeks before. Mm-hmm. There is that warning days before. Where, you know, generally you'll be able to climb a flight of stairs, you run up the stairs, and then now you're like feeling like you can't catch your breath, you're taking 2 minutes per step, that kind of thing. So decrease in your general exercise tolerance. And I see that a lot of the time where the patient says, you know, doc, I was able to run around the, I don't know what you guys call the stadium, but in Barbados, we used to call it like the stadium where you can run around, and they feel like they can't do that at all. So now they're going from running to just walking very slowly. So sometimes people say, oh, it feels like I'm, you know, deconditioning, but literally it is because the heart can't manage what it used to before because the blood vessel that used to supply that area of the muscle, which would, you know, be able to do what your heart's supposed to do generally, is now compromised to some extent.
That's interesting that you say that. So you know, I think most people think that our heart attack is like a sudden event. But you mentioning how it sometimes could be, you know, days on end and they have a change in actually their well-being before that actual sudden event. And I mean that's an interesting thought. How often do you see though people like without any prior illness or issues then have a sudden heart attack?
That's actually quite common. I think because a lot of people ignore certain things and they don't recognize. But then there is, you know, a few people. If I were to give numbers, I want to say about 30% of people actually have warning signs prior to.
But just as we say hypertension is a silent killer or cardiovascular disease is a silent killer, these things are manifesting over years.
Yes.
So that's why it's important to stratify persons, go for your annual physical, get your ECG, get your calcium score, get your
apolipoprotein B
marker, and let's make sure that we can prevent you from going down that road. It doesn't happen. That deposition and obstruction of the plaque doesn't happen in weeks or months. It happens over many, many years. And
yes.
It could be happening when you're in your 30s, your 40s, even you mentioned in your teenage years. So you got to live healthy from day one. You don't just of a sudden have an epiphany at 58 and say, you know what, I'm going to lose the 65 pounds that I've been carrying around and I'm going to stop the two-pack cigarette bad habit that I have and binge drinking every weekend. We pay for what we do.
Yes.
Earlier in life, later in life.
Exactly.
And we want to live longer and we want to live better.
Yeah.
And for Bahamians, you'll get to know the men, they want their erections into their 80s. And the way we can do that is to
take care of your heart.
Take care of your heart. So let's go back to basics. Everyone talks about cholesterol. There's actually good cholesterol. There's actually bad cholesterol. Cholesterol, when we talk about physiology, is fundamentally important. If we didn't have cholesterol, we'll die.
Yes.
They can be argued that the most important molecule in the brain is cholesterol.
Yes.
But let's talk a little bit more. What is good cholesterol? What is bad cholesterol? What's the importance of make sure that you have normal levels in terms of your lipid profile?
So your high-density lipoproteins are considered your good cholesterol.
But can you have too much of that?
Yes, you can. Okay. Yeah. And then there's also the LDL, which is considered to be your bad cholesterol. And also triglycerides, which people tend to not even talk about sometimes, those two can actually be quite high and be considered bad over time. So, you know, when you talk about high cholesterol, we're not just talking about the total number, but we also need to break down those, you know, different aspects of the cholesterol. So the HDL is one that we tend to want to be higher. Your LDL, you want to be lower. And when we talk about low, we're talking about a number less than 2. And I don't know what the units are here, but generally say less than 2 for most people. And then, you know, if you have had a history of a coronary event, we like it to be, you know, less than 50% of what you actually presented with.
When we, well, one of the more important things we're trying to talk about today is how do we prevent a heart attack. And when we look at the normal Bahamian, male and female adult in this society, they're all walking time bombs for a heart attack. It's the metabolic syndrome. It's the obesity and being overweight. It's the obstructive sleep apnea.
Oh, dear, yeah.
It's the high rate of diabetes and uncontrolled hypertension. But we've had this discussion many times, Dr. Wesley Francis. It's not only picking up those patients who have these disorders. It's getting them to follow up with physicals, getting repeat bloods, and taking the medication.
Yes.
So how can we, if we have to scare people into taking their high blood pressure medications, because every single day, I think it happened to me 3 times a day, Doc, I'm not taking my blood pressure medications.
Yes.
I'm fine.
I've seen that 5 times this week, to be honest, with a lot of young people, and it scares me because I am seeing a lot of people under 40 who have hypertension, and it's come to a point where it's actually affected the heart muscle. And I've also seen a lot of patients who are overweight who don't recognize the role that obesity plays in all of these diseases that you talked about, especially obstructive sleep apnea. Before, we didn't understand how important obstructive sleep apnea was, not only from the perspective of not having a good quality sleep, but also from the perspective of causing strain on the heart where your blood pressure spikes during the night. You're also at increased risk for causing strain on the heart to even cause things like atrial fibrillation. Again, something that is very common. We don't talk about those things in terms of how obesity has all these negative effects
the heart. When you want to get a male in the Bahamas to take a medication,
need a female.
the females are more compliant.
Yeah.
The male is not going to take it if it affects your erections. So unfortunately, a lot of these cardiac drugs affect your erections.
Yes.
Some of the high blood pressure medications affect.
Do.
How do we get around that? Are there different classes that we can put? Well, I know that we can do that for hypertension meds. We can get your blood pressure finally controlled, but allow you to get your erection. And the contrary is if you stop the medication, you're living in ignorance and the erection is going to be ruined anyway and
yes.
probably irreversibly so.
Agreed. So as for me, I always say that, especially when it comes to erectile dysfunction, it always tends to follow what may happen with the coronary arteries. So if you're not getting good erections, it may mean that your coronary arteries may be blocked. And certainly not taking the high cholesterol medications, again, can affect that. I know, especially for me as an electrophysiologist, a lot of patients worry about their beta blockers. So those are medications that you tend to give patients to lower their heart rates. That affects their erectile function. And for me, I think that it may affect a male, I tend to go for your calcium channel blockers, which have like less effect on your erection.
And everybody's different. I mean,
yeah.
just because one medication affects one individual in a certain
might
way
not
doesn't...
Agreed.
And the take-home messages we got back to earlier, we're talking about nitrates and
yes.
Viagra. You don't borrow anybody's medication.
Yes, agreed.
You don't treat yourself. You don't Google. You don't take medications for erections from the gas station. Go and see somebody, and you need to make sure that you have a list of all the medication. You can't say it's a round pill that's yellow. You can't say it's a brown pill that comes in a blue box. You need to know what medication, and everybody has a cell phone. Take pictures
yes,
of it.
Yes.
Know what dose that you're on and know when it started. So all you
got
to do is, a lot of patients even come in with a laminated card and say, all right, these are the medications I'm on. These are the dates that were started, and et cetera. That is fundamentally important because
Agreed.
You don't want to have cross reactions in
Riga. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to talk more about this and we're going to change the topic a little bit and talk about some interesting things on the other end of the break. This is Urology Speaks.
Get ready to swing for a cause. The 4th Annual Rebuilding Villages Charity Golf Tournament brought to you by Cleft of the Rock Foundation in proud partnership with the Bahamar Foundation. Join us on Sunday, October 5th at the world-class Royal Blue Golf Course at Bahamar in Nassau, the Bahamas, for a day of championship golf, community, and impact. This isn't just another tournament. It's a chance to change lives. Every putt, every drive, every swing supports programs like Parenting on Purpose and Disciplines for Life, empowering families across the Bahamas with education, awareness, and hope. Don't miss this unforgettable event, the 4th Annual Rebuilding Villages Charity Golf Tournament, October 5th. To register or learn more, visit cleftoftherockfoundation.org or email cleftoftherockfoundation@gmail.com.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bulla Boy in his phone.
What you mean? He take picture of that good-for-nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bulla hair. You say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior's phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want to find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it will go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for Crime Stoppers Bahamas, so you can call and nobody knows you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried the other day, and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick round the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and Bahamian surgical oncologist and general surgeon Dr. Wesley Francis. We're honored again to have in the studio the esteemed academic and consultant cardiologist Dr. Morris, who's from Barbados. We're trying to prevent heart attacks. We're trying to save the nation. It's the number one killer, far exceeding cancer, far exceeding gun violence, far exceeding car accidents and gun violence put together. So statistically speaking, you're likely to die of a cardiovascular event. We're trying to prevent that or prolong that from happening. So we want to see you live into your late 80s and into your early 90s and even beyond. So a lot of that has to do with lifestyle. A lot has to do with screening. I'll let you take the ball, Dr. Francis. We want to talk about cardiac ablation now.
Right. So we mentioned atrial fibrillation and some of the medical treatments, and then you mentioned cardioversion. Let's talk about some of the other therapies that you can use for correcting the rhythm of the heart.
Yeah, so something that I'm passionate about. So for me, I think that overall I like to make sure that my patient's quality of life is better. And I think for a lot of people, their quality of life decreases, especially when they have atrial fibrillation. A lot of people have palpitations from AFib. I think a challenge for them is that their heart rate goes from 50 to 130 pretty quickly. And that can last for several hours. And for these people, mostly, so for patients who are bothered from a symptom perspective, I tend to say I want those patients to be rhythm controlled, meaning that I want to maintain them into their normal rhythm as long as possible, not or reducing the amount of events that they have for atrial fibrillation. Unfortunately for AFib, there is not a cure, but there are drugs and there are procedures that you can undergo that reduces or minimizes your burden, or meaning the amount of times that your heart goes into this rhythm problem. So the drugs, as we call them, the antiarrhythmics or the rhythm drugs that prevent this rhythm problem, or is one of them. And then the next piece of it is having a minimally invasive procedure we call an ablation, where we take catheters generally through a major blood vessel in the groin. And that then goes into the heart. So we're talking about in the endocardium. Mm-hmm. And we are putting burns in the endocardium to minimize the burden of atrial fibrillation. It's not that it goes completely, but it may improve your symptoms because you going into atrial fibrillation is pretty much lowered to some extent.
Okay, we have a call. Yeah, good evening. Okay. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yeah, good afternoon to all. Good evening, rather, to all of you.
Good evening, sir.
John. Yes. John, I'd like to ask the young lady there.
Dr. Morris. Yes, Dr. Morris.
Dr. Morris. Does vinegar have any good effect on the arteries and the heart valve? Like, let's say, taking a teaspoon of vinegar every other day. Does that help with your arteries and your heart valve?
I don't know the answer to that question, and I want to say that I've never studied it, and I do not think it has any effects on the heart valves. I've never seen any studies. Generally, I'm a lady of putting evidence behind certain things that we do. So a lot of the drugs that we do, or a lot of chemicals that we use, we put it behind a group of patients, we test them, and then see what the outcomes are. So generally, if I don't have that information, I can't really comment on it. But generally, it's not something that has been, you know, tested on me having any knowledge on. That's the best way I can say it.
May I say, in times gone by, the old people used to clean meat with vinegar when they said they want to get all the slime and all of that off of the meat. So I always wondered what good vinegar would do for the arteries and the heart valve, if that's what it could do when you're cleaning meat. Because if you clean meat with vinegar, all the slime comes off.
Well, I think there's always the placebo effect as well. If you think it's doing good things for you, you're going to feel better and you're going to have a more positive outlook. And it sounds like you're very interested in your health, and that's very important. It's not going to do any harm. I'll take it a little step further. The most well-used drug on this earth is, without a doubt, caffeine. Is caffeine cardiovascular protective or harmful? Now, I know there have been a lot of studies for that, and there have been opposing views on both sides. So, that's the question. Is your 2 cups of coffee every morning good for your heart, or is it going to make likely that you're less likely to have a heart attack, or is it more likely to have a heart attack, or are there varying views that there's really no consensus?
I think there are varying views. As EP cardiologists, we tend to tell people, I don't think it has any effect on the heart, especially with rhythm problems. Certainly, a lot of people say, oh, doc, once I drink coffee, I tend to go into atrial fibrillation. I don't think there's any correlation there, to be honest. And generally, tell patients just continue their caffeine use. Obviously, not too much, because it can then become a stimulant. So I'm talking about over 4 cups of coffee a day. Generally not something that I would recommend.
Okay, I think we're going to change the talk a little bit. We have a well-known regional academic in our presence, and we always want to talk about trying to save the generation of men in our Bahama land. And there's a dangerous and troubling trend. We keep hammering home, and I think you've almost certainly seen that in Barbados. It's throughout the Caribbean. And that's that men are losing their way, and they don't see academics. They don't see studying as a way forward. They take no... studying is not a priority for them. They don't see a future in it. In fact, they're looked down because of it. When we have a consultant meetings here, Dr. Wesley and Francis and I might see a few of our male counterparts, but we're surrounded by women. And by every year, there are more and more women graduating in the medical fraternity, and there are more and more women becoming specialists, and we are almost extinct, Dr. Francis. So I think in the next generation, probably 90% of consultants in medical field and specialists in the Bahamas are going to be female. Why are men not, why are boys, let's start, why are boys, in your view, have no interest in academics, and why is it, how can we change that from continuing down this troubling trend?
I don't know, but what I can say is this. I think a lot of our generation has been impacted somehow by social media, and I think it has caused what we call an anxious generation. So a lot of people who do not get out and talk to, persons face to face, a lot of them are in social media watching what other people do. And that kind of starts this whole crisis of inertia. So thinking that knowledge is through Instagram, it's through Facebook. And a lot of our generation is pretty much very anxious and comparing themselves to other people. And I think a lot of what we tend to push in social media is, we don't have this whole thing about delayed gratification. Everybody wants something quick. It's about making money quickly. And I think that is being pushed a lot and in our faces. And we can see even like children are now getting devices at the age of 3 years old. And I think for me, I think that devices and pushing social media on children is actually what is somewhat killing our generation, and especially our generation of both men and women. From the men perspective, I feel like males are not really as affected as females are in the initial phases. But I feel like as time goes on, because a lot of them are into video games, they're kind of focused on these things. They're looking at other males who make money through social media and not studying or being academics. And they feel like, you know, they just want to get rich fast. Yeah, and that's what I feel a lot of us are dealing with.
If you were asked the average 7-year-old or 8-year-old what they want to be when they grow up, most of them want to be in the NBA or they want to be a rapper. And if they don't understand that the average rapper...
Or a content creator.
We'll talk about rappers and NBA players. The vast majority of them, 80, 90% with leaving the profession, are absolutely broke. In fact, more broke than when they started. Why don't they want to aspire to be Dr. Wesley Francis? So we need to have more positive role models. I think that's also very important. And there are too many, it's a matriarchal society. I'm sure Barbados is similar, where unfortunately a lot of the young boys, even if they're 13 or 14, have to shoulder a lot of the financial burden. So they have to work to support the family. They have to sacrifice their future and their time to study by helping get their younger siblings to bed, to get them, make sure that they eat on time, to make sure they wake up and get to school. So it's a sacrifice. And I don't see that. Where is the end in sight? Because it just keeps getting worse and worse generation by generation. I don't know how we're going to encourage men to take academics seriously. We always talk.
Well, I have a slightly different viewpoint. You know, I believe that in times past, women were somewhat marginalized, and we were intentional about giving women more opportunities, encouraging women to do well, and women, you know, they rose to the occasion. Right. I have two daughters, so and I push them. So I think now perhaps the pendulum needs to swing back a bit, where now we are more intentional about how we encourage young men and how we incentivize them and how we educate them and how we show them what, you know, what opportunities are available to them if they take a certain road. Yeah. Again, their role models are the rapper, the basketball player, because it's all the bling, okay? The content creator, whatever. But the numbers that I actually get there, I mean, it's like fractions, okay? Versus those who, if you take the academic road, you go on to developing, careers that'll certainly you'd prosper and you'd be able to provide for your family.
I mean, average NBA player may have a 4-year career. A surgeon can have a 40-year career.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but I think we need to be intentional. Okay, we have a caller.
Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good evening, this is Dr. Universe, along with you gentlemen and the lady.
Dr. Morris. Yes, Dr. Morris. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Dr. Pinto, I agree with what you had said, right? I grew up in a house where I had, together with six brothers of us, right?
Yes.
I'm the oldest. When I was going to school, I really wanted to be a medical doctor, right? But I went and got a job. You know, I went one year school to close for the summer, and I went and got a job. And after I started making money, I mean, it wasn't that much money, but it kept me from saving to go to school, you know, to go off to school.
Yes.
But I have a brother, right? Me and him used to be studying in our front room on the floor, you know?
Yes.
And here I am... He about he's about three years down from me, right? When I say 3 years, I have other brothers, right?
Yes.
And he make the third one with down from us. And today, like I said, we used to be studying on the floor in our front room. And today, he are a cardiologist.
Wow, that is amazing.
You know, and not only that, he was the first cardiologist in the Bahamas.
Wow.
I won't call his name.
We know who it is.
Say it again?
We know who it is.
That's amazing.
You know who it is?
Of course, we do, but yeah.
So I'm sure you played a fundamental role in that, in encouraging your brother.
Yeah. We love the book.
That.
But I said all of that pertaining to something you had said. I forgot the word in which you had used, right?
Yes.
But
where there's a will, there's a way.
Say it again?
Where there's a will, there's a way.
Where there's a will, there's
and,
a way.
And God will find a path for us all.
Yes, yes. And you know, I'm glad for him. He was the first cardiologist in the Bahamas.
That's extraordinary.
Yes, yes. And he wakes up out of the United States now.
Wow.
The last time I had spoken to him, he was responsible for two hospitals over there.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, I mean, great things can happen. My maternal grandfather didn't go past grade three. He had to teach himself how to read. He had to support his brothers and sisters. One of his brothers actually became the first Bahamian general surgeons in the early 1930s. So anything is possible. Anything is possible.
But, Doc, what I want to say to you also is this. You be encouraging people. You may not know that, right? But people love to hear you on the radio.
I appreciate it, and your encouragement means the world, and I'm just trying to be a guiding light in sometimes overwhelming darkness. But Dr. Francis and I are flickering light that are hopefully going to create a raging fire.
Yeah, well, may God encourage you all and strengthen you all to go on as long as he so desires.
Yes.
And thank you. And thank you all for your all time.
We're trying our best, as Dr. Francis calls himself the disciple, and I'm trying to be the shepherd of the Lord, but we're going to try to continue to do this every week and make a difference. So, yes, I am very impressed by your accomplishments, and I think that you will make a lot of changes and life-saving changes, not just for individuals, but as for the society as a whole. It's important that persons know that you are here. There are far too many. We mentioned it last week. We are creating a billion-dollar business for Florida.
Absolutely.
for medicine when we have specialists who are just as qualified, and literally, because you are our neighbor, because you are a church member, because we see you in the food store, we're going to take more heart and concern for you than a typical person who just sees the brown-skinned person coming from the Caribbean that they can get some money from. So it's important for us to know, how can we reach you if someone wants to have you review them? How can we find you?
Okay, so most of my practice is currently at the public hospital. So I'm at Princess Margaret Hospital. Besides that, I can be found at the Bahamas Surgical Association and Center. And I can also be found at Edenwell. And the last place is All Care Health Center, which operates out of the Ladies Medical Center.
On First Terrace, off Collins Avenue, yes.
Yes.
Okay, so you're all over the place. You're making waves already, and I'm sure you've already
saving
lives.
And then soon I'll be at Doctor's Hospital as well.
Wonderful.
That's great.
So no one needs to go off and try to seek your specific, highly specialized cardiology expertise. By going to Florida, you can get it right here. And that's all important. We have every form of medical specialty in this country.
We do. And as you say, we invest in healthcare in Florida.
And without investment, we're not going to make any advancements. We're not going to have the capital to go off and make changes. So please invest in your own, believe in your own people.
Yes.
That's all important.
I'm a strong believer of that.
Very much so. So particularly if you're dealing with a medical event, you want to be home. You want to be able to go home to your, you're surrounded by your family. You don't
support
is all important. You don't want to go. It's frightening enough to go through an ordeal, or
you don't want to be recovering in a hotel room.
You don't want to be recovering in a hotel room. You don't want to be surrounded by strangers, and not everyone's not going to be able to accompany you. So that's why you, Dr. Francis, and many of us sacrificed, went all around the world to try to get that specialty and then bring it back home.
Yes.
And as you'll find, and Francis and I have found, it's not always going to be easy, but when you're pioneers, you have a lot of gratification when you make a difference, because it's here you can be a big fish in a small pond and you can make a huge difference. So God bless Bahamas. Thank you, Dr. Morris. I think we have a lot more to talk. We only scratched the surface in terms of cardiology.
Definitely have to bring her back.
I think we need to make this a series, a cardiology series. Right. The number one killer in this country is heart disease. So you are all important in trying to save lives.
Yes.
Knowledge is key. Please let's come back, even if it's once every month, every 2 months. We'll continue this as a series, a cardiology series with the Urologist Speaks. Have a very safe and fruitful week, Bahamas, and good evening. Thank you again, Dr. Morris.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Think you're losing grip of on hope.
Don't be ashamed. It's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.